or meaning. Parker, although his hands were starting to shake and tire from holding the lantern, kept the beam focused.
"What the hell is this mess?" Andrews asked White.
White paused, looking at the set of wires.
"I don't know what you mean, sir."
"When I come across a series of wires on a ship that I have designed and even I don't know what they are, I ask questions."
Andrews grabbed the wires, dragging them up so that White could get a closer look. Parker could see that his friend was angry.
"What are these?"
"I think that they are the circuit ground wires."
Andrews shook his head, disagreeing.
"Impossible. Those are located on the other side of the board and they're insulated."
"No, sir,"
White insisted.
"Those are it."
Andrews gave Parker a puzzled look. Behind the worry, the archaeologist noticed an angry confusion.
"Damn."
Andrews cursed between his teeth.
"We're going to have to rewire the whole damn board. White, give me your wire cutters."
"Hold that beam, mate," White instructed Parker.
Parker noticed Smith's hands patting his shoulders. He could feel the worry growing in them. The captain remained relatively silent during the whole affair. Parker understood. With knuckles freshly bleeding, Andrews rewired the whole circuit board leading to the primary control. He taped up the newly laid wire and crawled out of the cubbyhole and moved his way to the main switches.
"Miss this or get out the candles," Andrews warned.
The captain cleared his throat and gave the order.
"Flip them, Mr. Andrews."
Andrews turned the switches. The light bulbs in the power room played tricks with the men. Then suddenly, there was light. Yellow, all-knowing, all-seeing. It was a beauty to behold. Cheers welled up in everybody's throats. White's crew yanked, slapped, and embraced. All was again normal. Parker heard a crashing sound from behind and put down his lantern. He turned to see what it was. Parker saw a crewman standing only feet away from him and realized that the crashing sound came from a wrench the man dropped.
"What's wrong, man?"
White asked as he put his coat back on. Only having the power to point, the crewman directed everyone's attention to the broken and bleeding body at his feet. It was Rollins. His heart had been ripped out. April 13th, 1912. Turbine Room, 12:30 a.m. The Titanic's doctor leaned over Rollins's body and did his best not to get sick.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph. What's going on here aboard this ship?"
The doctor made a sign of the cross as he pulled himself up from the body. Rollins' body lay in a cloth bag waiting to be stacked with the rest. The surgery was fast becoming a morgue. Cott's fingers were going crazy. He was writing down everything he was seeing, everything the people around him were saying, and any other thought that came to mind. That was the business of the detective.
"The time of the man's death, doctor?"
Cott asked.
2 hours, the doctor replied.
"About the time of the blackout?"
"About."
Cott saw something that caught his eye as he walked past the body. It was something shiny.
"Hello," Cott said, leaning down to investigate. "What's this?"
"Is something wrong?"
Smith asked.
"There appears to be something lodged inside the victim's rib cage,"
Cott explained, rather fascinated.
"Possibly left there by the killer."
"You mean the mummy," Smith corrected.
Cott let out an anguished sigh. It was not easy for him, an officer of the law, having to live with facts and the proving of them, to accept the supernatural. As exciting as the situation appeared, all the facts did point to the ancient mummy. As far as Cott was concerned, he would be quite happier going after Jack the Ripper.
"The mummy, yes."
Cott reached inside the red cavity inside Rollins' chest, pulling out a small golden insect. Smith let out a gasp of surprise, bringing the detective's face a swell of satisfaction.
"It's a pleasure to see that you can still be surprised, Captain."
"You've never sailed inside the Devil's Triangle," Smith pointed out. "There you will see the impossible."
"Quite,"
Cotts agreed, pulling out a handkerchief, wiping off the blood. The golden insect was no bigger than an American silver dollar. It looked more like a beetle than any other creature. Cotts wondered, why leave it on a man's chest?
"What's this?" Cotts asked of himself.
"I guess you could call it Kyrie's calling card,"
Parker said.
Surprised, Kotz turned from Rollins' body to see Dennis Parker standing over him. "Do you know what this is supposed to mean?" Kotz asked, showing the insect to Parker. Parker studied the detective. "How do you know that it was left as a message?" "Experience," Kotz pointed out. "While I investigated the Ripper murders, it came to my attention that he was taking the victim's tokens and arranging them in simple patterns at their feet. Upon further investigation, I came to the conclusion that the Ripper wanted to be caught and was arranging the patterns in a way to point to his identity." "What did these patterns say?" Parker asked, amused. "The masonry," Kotz said. "Incredible," Smith replied. "I know several gentlemen in London who belong to the Brotherhood. You're not saying that the Ripper was one of them, are you?"
"Quite."
"Unbelievable." Kotz noticed Parker's stare. Focused on the golden insect in his hand, Kotz understood the boy's curiosity. However, the detective was under the impression that just like his experience in the Ripper murders, Parker knew the truth behind this rather odd clue. "You know the meaning behind this, don't you, son?"
"Yes, I think I do."
The detective handed Parker the insect and gave the young man a curious glance. Parker was a man who had done well. As far as Kotz was concerned, there was nothing more gratifying than watching a man gain importance in a harsh world. Parker studied the item, giving it his full attention. Smith, who was standing nearby, looked on, trying to make himself useful. In actuality, Kotz knew that the captain was as lost in the dark as he was.
"This is not just any beetle, Mr. Kotz," Parker pointed out.
"Then what is it?"
"A scarab," Parker said. "Most commonly known as the black-winged dung beetle. It was once held sacred by the ancient Egyptians."
"What was its purpose?" Kotz asked, getting out his notebook.
"It was meant to represent the heart of this man."
Parker pointed to Rollins.
"Weird."
"Not as weird as a cross, Inspector."
Kotz let out an ironic laugh. Parker noticed some ancient writing on the scarab, bringing it to Kotz's attention.
"See here?
Looks like doodling to me."
"It's ancient Egyptian text."
Kotz focused his eyes, trying his best to make the writing out.
"What does it mean?"
Parker cleared his throat.
"It is our death warrant."
"What are you saying?"
Parker handed the item back to Kotz.
"The inscription is a prayer to Ka-Ra's god. She's terrified. She believes that we want to sail off the edge of the world. She has called upon her god to stop us."
"Stop us?"
the captain asked.
"To sink us," Parker clarified.
"Impossible," Smith shouted. "This ship's unsinkable."
"Excuse me, gentlemen,"
Andrews apologized. Silently, he motioned Parker to join him. Kotz bowed his goodbye as Parker walked over to Andrews, who seemed to be involved with the ship's circuit boards.
"Strange man," Smith mused, watching Parker walk away.
12:55 a.m. Andrews paid little attention to the fact that he was no longer standing at the circuit board alone. He seemed too involved with the discovery he made.
"What's wrong?" Parker asked.
Andrews turned to see Parker looking at him.
"You got some time. What do you have in mind?"
Andrews grabbed his blueprints.
"We're going to Ismay's quarters to have a talk."
"Ismay,"
Parker said with a face. "Do we have to?"
"Most certainly."
"Why?"
"Whatever it is you have to say, the man won't listen. He's stuck on himself."
"Hell," Parker scoffed.
"He probably doesn't even know that we had a blackout."
Andrews gave Parker's observations a thought.
"No. I've come to the conclusion that there is a lot about this ship Mr. Ismay has kept to himself."
"What are you getting at?"
Parker started to show concern.
"These are not the breakers that I designed for this dynamo."
Andrews pointed to the board with a trembling finger.
"It looks big enough."
"Looks, yes,"
Andrews stated. "The wiring is for a ship half this size. It's a damn wonder the breakers hadn't gone out sooner."
Parker gave what his friend was saying some thought. Cost cuts were no stranger to him. Many a time he had been the victim of inferior tools and guides because some London chairman wanted to pocket the cash. He was saddened by the fact that Andrew's work had to be the victim.
"Thomas, I'm sorry."
Andrew shook his head, hoping that he was wrong.
Both left the power room, heading for Ismay's quarters. E-Deck, second class entrance, 1 o'clock a.m. Ka-Ray pounded the side of the ship with a clenched fist and cursed the gods. Why, after so many centuries of peace, had they forgotten her? She was faithful. She followed the rules. How could they just let her sail off the world's edge into oblivion? It was time for her to take action. After all, she was once a powerful priestess, most skilled in the black arts. Human sacrifice? There was no other way. If she were to save herself from the abyss, she would have to bribe the gods with blood. She dragged her dirty feet down a ship's corridor, passing a kissing couple who were oblivious of her presence and knew that she had no other option. The Titanic had to be destroyed. Chapter 12 MGY, MGY, RMS Titanic, Ice Warning, Ice Warning. Heavy field of ice encountered at 42 north to 51 west. Captain wishes good voyage. Californian out. B deck, suite B-51, 3 o'clock a.m.
Of course we had to cut corners, Ismay yelled, trying his best to keep Andrew's hands from around his neck. We did it for the greater good of the company.
The company, Andrew screamed. God damn your business for all I care. What have you done to my ship?
Ismay pleaded.
The building of the Olympic was too much for us. We hadn't the money to build two more of us, so I received word to cut the cost on Titanic's construction.
Who gave the order?
Ismay started to speak, but then paused.
Spit it out, man, Andrews warned. Or I'll kill you where you stand.
The order came from J.P. Morgan, the owner of the White Star Line. I had no choice in the matter.
Andrew's hands fell limply to his sides. The shipbuilder was shocked. Ismay kept his eyes on Andrews, expecting another fight.
I'm sorry to have to be the one to tell you, Mr. Andrews.
That explains it.
What?
Asked Parker, shaken by Andrew's rage.
Why I was always called away to a damn board meeting whenever I had made plans to investigate her completion. Every single time something happened, someone managed to stop me.
Parker stepped forward. He had been watching the fight from the corner of the room.
How safe is this ship? He asked.
Andrews, unsure, looked at Ismay.
As safe as her design, Ismay proclaimed.
As safe as her design, I doubt it.
Andrews handed his blueprints to Parker, showing him the ship's original design specifications.
I wanted to stock her with over 50 lifeboats.
The board did nothing wrong.
Ismay started wiping the nervous sweat from his brow.
I wanted to give her a double bottom.
She's too big to sink, Ismay barked.
I wanted to level off her watertight compartments.
She won't sink, Ismay insisted.
Parker handed the blueprints back to Andrews and stated,
It does no good to protest. The damage is already done. However, if I were you, Mr. Ismay, I'd think about changing careers.
What do you mean?
The White Star Line might be a British company, but she is owned by an American interest. I must warn you, defraud is not taken lightly in the United States.
We didn't do anything wrong, Ismay pleaded.
That is for Congress to decide, sir, Parker stipulated. Our laws are quite clear. Someone will complain, perhaps someone of power. A U.S. Senate investigation might be called. Before any other surprises happen to bump our way, Mr. Ismay, would you please tell me what other corners you might have cut?
Andrews asked, fighting back a long yawn. Ismay remained silent.
Mr. Ismay, Parker pleaded.
I have my career to consider.
That's lovely, Andrews yelled. The ship has fallen apart. There's a monster on board killing everything in sight, and his lordship is worried about his job.
Andrews doubled up his fist, wishing to shoot the man.
You damn fool. Always thinking more about the pound sterling than the human souls you destroy with it.
Tom,
Parker pleaded, doing his best to hold his friend at bay.
You're getting nowhere with this. The man isn't even listening to you. In his eyes, you're the villain. Bad guy, am I?
I'll show him a bad guy.
Parker had seen enough for one evening and pulled his friend out of the suite.
What the hell's wrong with you, Thomas?
Parker asked, letting go of Andrews in the hall. Several bystanders listened with great interest, doing their best not to look like they were eavesdropping.
If he goes to court, I go with him, Dennis.
How so?
I'm the chief engineer,
Andrews pointed out.
Who do you think these company big shots have signing all the paperwork? Me. That's who. I'm as guilty as they are.
It isn't your fault, Parker argued. They tricked you. They lied to you.
The men remained quiet until they were sure they were alone in the hall.
What are you going to do now? Parker asked.
Andrews gave the question considerable thought.
The Olympic is sound. I'd stake my life on her. The Titanic, however, needs to be touched up here and there.
How safe is she at the moment, then?
My friend, we are sailing on a disaster waiting to happen.
Parker could feel a nervous lump growing in his throat. April 14th, 1912, 300 miles from New York, 7:30 p.m. Titanic, Titanic, this is Californian. Have been forced to stop for the night. Huge ice pack blocking our way. Advise that you keep extra lookouts. Californian, Californian, this is Titanic. Keep out. Shut up. You're jamming my signal. Titanic's forward crow's nest, 11:20 p.m. Lookouts Frederick Fleet and Reginald Lee stomped their feet trying to stay warm. The cold Atlantic had lowered the temperature to 31 degrees. The wind was blowing wildly, making the chill factor almost zero.
I hope they don't drink all the bloody tea, shouted Lee, trying to fight the nip in the air.
Quit your bitching, Fleet joked. What do you want out of life anyway? Happiness?
I'd settle for a cup of my mom's cocoa at the moment.
Just what I need tonight. A comedian.
If you don't like my jokes, Lee challenged, relieve me.
Fleet ignored the challenge. Fleet scanned the horizon, rubbing his tired eyes. The sea was as calm as glass.
Wish we were allowed those binoculars back in Southampton.
Lee rubbed his hands together, blowing hot breath into them.
What? Fleet laughed. Actually be able to perform our job?
The men were standing in a box about the size of an average closet high above the main bow mast. Fleet could hear the sounds of a dinner party winding down.
Sounds like they're having fun, he remarked. For the wealthy, every night's a party night.
The men laughed. Fleet peered out over the crow's nest and noticed a couple crewmen below. Walking across the bow, the crewmen were closing up the forward forecastle hatch.
What are those buggers doing?
Fleet asked, shouting into Lee's ear.
The old man probably sent them down to keep the light out of our eyes, Fleet explained. Lots of ice warnings from what I hear. Why don't they just stop the ship?
Lee comically slapped his friend on the back of the head as if to punish Fleet for asking such stupid questions. Fleet noticed one of the crewmen below waving up at him. The lookout watched the young man as he clapped his arms together and run back into the crew's main quarters.
Lucky man, Fleet thought. He's going to be drinking tea in a moment.
An object grabbed at Fleet's attention from the corner of his eye. Rising up from the horizon, a black mass caught the lookout's gaze. If it weren't for the things bobbing up and down in the water, Fleet would never have seen it. He peered carefully and witnessed the faint shimmer of a smooth surface. Iceberg.
Christ, Lee, we got a bug! Fleet cried. What? I can't see it.
Lee peered, panic-stricken. A faint trace of fear shook in his throat as he talked.
How far away? My guess is less than a mile. Where's the damn thing? Lee demanded.
Fleet pointed toward the oncoming mass. He could hear the fear growing in his co-worker's voice.
Cold a bridge, Freddy,
Lee gulped, paying no attention to the cold air.
Dear God, call them now. Right you are.
Fleet rang the warning bell three times. He grabbed the phone, piping the bad news to the bridge.
Yes?
The voice was Sixth Officer Moody's.
Iceberg right ahead, sir.
How far?
Moody asked.
500 yards away, towering some 50 or 60 feet above the waterline.
Fleet thought he heard a controlled gasp.
Right, was all Moody could say. All Fleet and Lee could do was watch and wait. Bridge, 11:35 p.m. With a shaky hand, Moody gave the phone to Murdoch, who relieved Lightoller. Captain Smith had turned in for the evening, giving special orders to wake him if anything out of the ordinary occurred.
Out of the ordinary,
the first officer thought, holding the phone in his hand.
Huh. That's all this voyage has been.
Chasing down an undead monster bent on murder and destruction.
God, all I want to do is reach New York.
It's Fleet, sir,
Moody said. His tone was not normal. Murdoch studied his sixth officer's face.
It's not good, sir.
Murdoch cleared his throat.
Murdoch here.
Mr. Murdoch, sir.
Fleet's voice could barely be heard.
Berg dead ahead.
It's position,
the first officer demanded.
Ahead right. Right you are. Steady lads, we'll take care of it.
Murdoch hung up the phone.
What now? Moody asked.
Murdoch studied the faces of the men around him. They were scared.
Calm down, gentlemen. We're not dead yet.
A nervous laugh came from the quartermaster. Dim the lights, please, Murdoch ordered. Someone clicked the lights off, and the first officer peered out into the dark Atlantic. Murdoch saw it. Huge, oncoming, deadly.
Sweet Jesus,
he gasped in horror. The Titanic was steadily steaming in a direct line to the iceberg. The ship, even with all its wonders, could in no way avoid a collision. Murdoch realized that the ship would not turn in time. He served on the Olympic. Murdoch knew what the Titanic could take. Her best hope? Hit the berg head on. Murdoch ordered,
slow ahead.
What?
The quartermaster barked. Murdoch tried to remain calm.
I have no time to explain. Trust me.
Perplexed, the quartermaster's eyes went from his wheel to the first officer and to the looming black mass which, with every second, was coming closer to the ship. Death was getting ready to knock on their door.
Ram her,
Murdoch ordered.
What about her bow?
If we ram, we only damage the bow,
the first officer explained.
We will never be able to turn in time.
Moody stepped forward.
Mr. Murdoch, are you crazy?
I served on her sister. I know what she can take.
The quartermaster's eyes turned, pleading for some logic from the sixth officer.
Do what you have been ordered to do, mister.
Moody crossed himself.
Slow ahead, quartermaster,
Murdoch whispered. With sweating hands, the quartermaster moved the bridge's telegraph to slow ahead. B deck, stern bridge, 11:38 p.m.
No, Mr. Murdoch,
Kare yelled, her voice throbbing with rage inside her mind.
I will not allow you the opportunity to save your ship, although your duty. I shall do all in my power to stop you.
Kare slowly climbed the stairs leading to the stern bridge. She decided to take control of the Titanic's destiny. The stern bridge, identical to the main bridge in almost every way, was the only other point of the ship where she could use her magic. She tore up the floor, grabbed a series of wires and pipes, and pulled them out. Sparks flew everywhere. Enough electrical current passed through her body to kill any man. All navigational control to the main bridge had been cut off. The Titanic was under Kare's control.
Aten, give me the knowledge of these men,
Kare prayed, grabbing hold of the stern bridge's wheel.
Give me their thoughts, their fears, and their dreams. Allow me the power to guide this great ship to your outer world doors. Let this Titanic be my funeral barge.
Kare dragged herself to the stern bridge's telegraph and clicked its indicator to stop engines. After a few seconds, she moved it again to full astern. The engine crew followed their orders. Kare silently rejoiced, knowing that the gods had not forgotten her and that her 30-century wait had not been in vain.
Praise the gods, for they are all eternal, she mused.
Ka-Ray turned the ship's wheel as far to the left as possible. The Titanic, creaking and fighting every inch of the way, started to respond to her orders. If it had been possible, Ka-Ray would have laughed. Bridge, 11:40 p.m.
"Control's not responding, sir," the quartermaster shouted.
Murdoch turned from the wheelhouse's windows, giving the quartermaster a look of controlled panic.
"What?"
Murdoch shouted, walking to the ship's wheel, studying the controls.
"Explain."
The quartermaster was trying to keep the wheel from turning to the left. It was as if the thing had a mind of its own.
"I can't, sir. The ship's engines have gone crazy, too."
Sixth Officer Moody studied the quartermaster's instruments. Murdoch could see that Moody wasn't taking the QM seriously. Moody tried to turn the ship's wheel and had the same problems.
"Controls are jammed, sir," Moody confirmed. "Someone has ordered hard to starboard." "Impossible," Murdoch stated. "I never gave the order."
A dark shadow fell upon those on the bridge. The iceberg was getting closer. Forward Crow's Nest, 11:41 p.m. With the phone still in his hand, all Frederick Fleet could do was watch the iceberg as it slowly loomed over him and the Titanic. The black silhouette grew larger and larger.
"Move the bloody ship, lads," Fleet found himself praying. "God damn it, do something before it's too late."
The Titanic, moving slowly in still waters, continued as if nothing was happening. After what seemed an eternity, the ship's bow turned 22 degrees to port. The ship was finally beginning to turn. The Titanic was going to clear the iceberg. Fleet braced himself for impact. The 70-foot dark white mound of ice scraped the Titanic's side, bouncing off the hull several times as the ship continued on its way. The berg shattered with each encountering bounce, raining chunks of ice onto the ship's decks, giving the impression of a winter blizzard. Fleet could feel the foremast swing from side to side due to the encounter, making it impossible for him to remain on his feet.
"We're done for," Lee shouted.
"Shut up," Fleet ordered, keeping his eyes glued to the moving wall of ice. "It appears to have done no harm."
Fleet watched the berg as it continued its journey down the Titanic's starboard side, disappearing astern. As fast as the encounter had begun, it was over. The whole thing lasted only 10 seconds.
"Didn't even chip the bloody paint," Fleet said, relieved and amazed. "Maybe this ship is unsinkable."
Bridge, 11:43 p.m.
"Collision alert!" Murdoch yelled.
Moody, following the first officer's orders, hit the collision alarm button. A red light started to blink, accompanied by a loud and irritating bell.
"Close all watertight doors," Murdoch shouted. "Closing watertight doors, sir."
Moody grabbed the watertight door control and quickly turned the dial. The sixth officer continued to turn the small silver lever until the doors lit up on the board, indicating that all the compartments were complying.
"Watertight doors responding, sir," Moody confirmed.
"My God," Murdoch remembered. "Somebody better wake the captain."
Although it appeared to the first officer that the Titanic succeeded admirably in her encounter with the berg, he couldn't seem to shake the feeling of panic in his stomach or stop his hands from shaking.
"Somebody stop off in the galley and get me a cup of tea," he begged.
Murdoch walked out onto the starboard bridge wing, wanting to keep his eye on the berg until it safely disappeared. However, upon looking past the stern of the ship, there was no iceberg to be found. It was gone.
"Where did the damn thing go?"
the first officer wondered. Chapter 13. Captain's Quarters, 11:50 p.m. Captain Smith had been awakened from the first decent night's sleep he had since the killings began.
"What is it, son?"
Smith asked the young seaman standing at his cabin door.
"We've struck a berg, sir," the boy explained. "Mr. Murdoch requests your presence on the bridge at once."
The captain gave the young man a curious glance.
"Struck an iceberg, you say?"
"Yes, sir, just moments ago."
"I felt nothing."
"It wasn't serious, sir, just a scrape."
Smith instinctively reached for his captain's hat.
He dropped his feet into his shoes, wrapped himself in a thick coat, and headed for the bridge. The ship appeared to be sound.
"Which side of the ship did the bug strike?" Smith asked.
He and the young seaman exited the officer's quarters corridor, out onto the deck. The young man had to run, keeping in step with his worried superior.
"Starboard side, sir."
"Damn," Smith said under his breath. The captain was doing his best to remain calm. Upon reaching the bridge, Smith found it to be in a state of chaos. Smith motioned to Boxhall to follow him out onto the starboard bridge wing.
"Mr. Boxhall, you will stay with me."
Boxhall, who had been helping Murdoch with damage reports, silently looked at the first officer to see if he protested. There was no reply.
"Coming, sir."
Smith peered over the bridge wing, trying to see if he could catch a glimpse of the iceberg. There was nothing for him to see. Again, the captain cursed.
"Where's the ship's carpenter?" Smith asked, rubbing a worried hand across his beard. "Shall I fetch him, sir?" "Immediately."
Boxhall rushed off the bridge, following his captain's orders. Smith, seeing no sign of the iceberg, returned to the bridge, finding all his officers looking at him.
"Stop all engines, Mr. Murdoch," Smith ordered. "I think we should stay put until the ship is pronounced sound."
"Sir,"
Murdoch replied. Silently pointing to the quartermaster, the first officer passed on his captain's request. The quartermaster took hold of the engine's telegraph, motioning the indicator to stop. The engine room responded in kind, returning the order with a ringing bell.
"All engines stop, sir," the quartermaster said.
The rhythmic throbbing of the Titanic suddenly started to die down. Everyone on the bridge could feel it. The ship was dead in the water.
"Sir, I have found the carpenter,"
Boxhall shouted. Smith got the impression that his sixth officer had dragged the man out of his bunk. The ship's carpenter reported to his captain with a tired salute. The man was barely able to regain his professional composure.
"Reporting is ordered, sir."
"Sir, the ship has been struck by an iceberg," the captain explained.
The ship's carpenter's eyes showed concern.
"Sir?"
"I wish for you to sound the ship. Discover the damage caused by this encounter, then bring your findings to me. With any luck, we'll be ready to get underway in about an hour."
"I shall do my best, sir."
"Indeed you shall."
With a click of his heels, the carpenter rushed off the bridge.
"Quartermaster," Smith shouted.
Leaving another officer at the wheel, the quartermaster stepped forward.
"Yes, sir."
"Do you know where Mr. Andrews is bunking?"
"I think so, sir."
"Find him," Smith demanded. "We need his input here."
The young quartermaster looked back at his station. Smith could sense the man's desire to remain at his post and for a second admired the young officer's sense of duty.
"Move it, mister," Smith shouted.
"Sir."
Smith watched the quartermaster run off the bridge. After the first 10 minutes of impact, water started to rise 14 feet above the ship's keel forward. The first 5 compartments began to take on water. After his inspection, the ship's carpenter brought the captain bad news. A deck, Suite A-36, 11:55 p.m. Andrews heard a knock at his door, waking him from a restful sleep. He found himself in his chair with several blueprints on his lap and rubbed his eyes, trying to focus them in the dark.
"Come in," he said.
Shoving the door open, the quartermaster rushed in.
"Mr. Andrews, the captain wishes to see you on the bridge."
Andrews could feel it. The ship was no longer under power.
"Why have the engines stopped?"
he demanded.
"We struck an iceberg."
"When did this happen?"
"About 20 minutes ago, sir."
Andrews grabbed his blueprints and followed the quartermaster to the bridge. April 15th, 1912. Bridge, 12 o'clock a.m. Upon reaching the bridge, Kotz knew that something was wrong. He had returned to his room after confirming several autopsies with the ship's doctor and was awakened by a curious bump that seemed to vibrate through the entire ship. At first, the detective thought that the sudden movement was an explosion. However, upon further investigation, he began to feel differently. The detective noticed Smith pacing back and forth on the starboard bridge wing and was practically knocked off his feet by Ismay, who, upon entering the bridge, started to ask questions.
"I demand to know why this ship has stopped."
"I'm sounding the ship," Smith stated.
"Sounding?"
Ismay asked.
"For what reason?" "We've struck an iceberg."
Ismay filled the bridge with an arrogant laugh. This laugh, Kotz observed, received a cold stare from almost every Titanic officer.
"I'm glad that you find this amusing, sir," Murdoch shouted. "This ship could be severely damaged."
"Not the Titanic."
Smith stopped Ismay's bragging.
"The carpenter has informed us of a major leak in the forward areas."
"How bad a leak?"
"Serious enough, Mr. Ismay."
Smith's voice had a warning tone to it.
"We may need the use of the lifeboats."
Kotz started to regret his voyage on the Titanic.
"Now just a minute," Ismay barked. "Aren't you rushing things here?" "To make sure, I have sent for Mr. Andrews. I shall await his opinion before I take further actions,"
Smith said, doing his best to calm Ismay down. Everyone noticed the fear growing in Bruce Ismay's eyes, but none had the tact to question him. Kotz saw the captain giving him a curious stare.
"Mr. Kotz," Smith motioned Kotz with a finger. "Would you come here?"
Kotz walked over, taking his notepad out of his vest pocket. The detective wanted to inform Smith of the doctor's findings on the autopsies, but the seasoned lawman knew that this was never to be. Smith's brow seemed to carry more serious troubles than that of a loathsome murderer.
"Captain," Kotz tried to reply, "I have just spoken with the doctor, and he informs me that none of the victims..." "That's fascinating, Mr. Kotz," Smith interrupted. "Would you be so kind as to escort Mr. Ismay back to his suite?"
Kotz let out a disagreeable grunt.
"I'd rather he didn't, if you don't mind," Ismay insisted.
The detective noticed the look of disgust he was receiving from the company executive.
"Oh, how I hate this man," Kotz thought. "I'd give 20 years of my life to prove that he was our killer and not this damn mummy." The supernaturalist sighed. "This pampered ass wouldn't have the balls to boil milk, let alone slosh a man's throat."
Ismay gave Kotz a hard eye, saying,
"I mean, really, doesn't he ever change his clothes?"
Kotz noted the anger growing in the captain's eyes. The detective started to appreciate the respect Smith was starting to show him and regarded it as the proudest professional relationship he had ever known.
"Mr. Ismay, must I remind you who's in command here?" Smith warned. "You will keep a civil tongue as long as I am on this bridge."
Ismay huffed, not at all pleased at being put in his place.
"To be escorted by a commoner, it is unheard of."
Kotz grunted, amused.
"Captain Smith, I would consider it an honor to escort Mr. Ismay."
Kotz gave the captain a wink as he dragged a cursing Ismay off the bridge. Lightoller walked up to his captain, bringing him the latest damage reports.
"What of the inspector's investigation, sir?" "That, Mr. Lightoller, is beyond my concern at the moment. I have my ship to consider."
F-Deck, Third Class Cabins, 12:05 a.m.
"Fight all you wish, ship. It is my intentions to make sure that you die,"
Kare raged. Kare tore open sealed portholes, allowing the dark green waters of the North Atlantic to pour in at her feet.
"You paid no heed to the warnings at my tomb," she pointed out, beating the ship's walls as she continued her destructive trek. "Warnings inscripted by my hand. Authored by my intention not to be disturbed. In killing you, ship, I kill those who have ignored the will of the gods."
Kare walked through the halls of the lower decks, not caring who saw her. Screams from frightened women filled the corridors. Corridors, though grandiose in their designs, cared not for their inhabitants' comforts.
"Send your men, great Pharaoh, Captain. I await your test. Let your chariots attack me."
"Stop!" a man shouted.
Kare saw a young man holding a weapon at her. Kare couldn't understand the device, but she knew it to be dangerous. With water trailing at their feet, both figures stood watching the other.
"You will stop what you're doing now," the young man warned.
"You do not scare me, little boy,"
Kare silently challenged.
"There is nothing you can do to me that hasn't already been done."
Kare's face twisted with a perverted delight as she pushed her fingers through the man's ribcage, pulling out his heart. Screams echoed through the hall. An old woman fainted. A priest started to pray. Ka-Ray handed the bloody organ back to its owner and continued her trek down the port side of the ship, knocking out the Titanic's portholes. The Irishman dropped his gun, vomiting black blood through his screaming mouth. Captain's Quarters, 12:10 a.m. Captain Smith paced the floor of his cabin as Thomas Andrews looked over his blueprints. He had only one question to answer. Was the Titanic safe to sail? Andrews was the only authority on board who knew enough about the Olympic-class vessel to respond to this issue. The captain had no need to press an answer. He could see it in the man's face. Andrews placed his slide rule on Smith's desk and said rather absent-mindedly, "I cannot believe this."
"What?"
Andrews wouldn't answer. Instead, he silently shook his head no.
"Mr. Andrews, tell me what's going on, please."
Andrews started to draw several dots across the blueprints of the Titanic. Smith watched with interest.
"The berg that hit us certainly was a calculating bitch. She knew how to sink us."
Smith glared at Andrews. His jaw tightened.
"Yes, Captain," Andrews confirmed. "We are done for."
"How?"
Smith asked, his voice pleading for an answer.
"Why?"
"As the iceberg scraped our starboard side, she bounced off the hull, popping the rivets holding us together."
Andrews paused, thinking. "It's also entirely possible that the colliding berg breached the keel."
"Then there is nothing we can do to stop the flooding."
Andrews said,
"Not even God could save this ship."
"I do not understand," Smith shouted.
A lost look of hurt entered the captain's eyes. Andrews studied the pain and understood.
"Look here, sir."
The shipbuilder started to draw a straight red line through the Titanic's forward sections.
"Water in the forepeak, number one hold, number two hold, the mail room, boiler room number six, and boiler room five. The facts, let alone the oncoming water, show several punctures throughout the ship's hull. Or, if you prefer, a 300-foot gash, leaving the first five compartments hopelessly flooded."
Smith still did not want to accept the situation.
"This ship is supposed to be unsinkable," Smith pointed out. "You promised that fact to all the world."
"I did nothing of the kind. In worst-case scenario, she was designed to stay afloat for 3 days. I promised a sound ship."
"Sound ship, is it? She sinks like a rock."
These words hit Andrews hard. Long ago, he punched a man in the mouth for uttering those words to him. Once, men praised him for it. Would they praise him now?
"Look, sir,"
Andrews tried to explain, biting back his own pain.
"The Titanic could float with any two of her 16 watertight compartments flooded. She could float with three of the first five compartments flooded. She could even float with the first four entirely gone."
Smith studied the blueprints, paying attention to the red marks the shipbuilder had been marking.
"Not with the first five altogether?" Smith asked.
"Correct,"
Andrews insisted, realizing that he was getting through.
"The fifth watertight compartment only goes as high as E-deck. After that, the bow sinks below the waterline, causing the others to fall in on themselves."
Andrews paused.
"It is a mathematical certainty, pure and straightforward. There is no way out."
With a hard face, Captain Smith took his hat off and glared at his White Star emblem.
"I was to retire after this trip, Mr. Andrews."
"Sir?"
The shipbuilder was busy going over calculations.
"I am 59, Smith chuckled. "A man is to retire when he is my age, when a man can look back on what he has accomplished."
Andrews stopped his calculating, paying more attention to what the officer had to say.
"I worked so hard to wear this hat, sir. Worked hard my whole life."
Smith let out a proud sigh.
"White Star even gave me the singular honor of mastering each new ship on the maiden voyages. I'll tell you, sir, that is the honor of being a sailor."
"I admire this man," Andrews thought, sharing the old man's pain. "To be able to look back on what he has accomplished with such zeal. Let his death be an honorable one."
"A sailor to make a daughter proud, sir,"
Andrews said. Upon saying those words, Smith's eyes started to fill with tears. Instinctively, his hand patted his coat pocket where he always kept a cigar. Cigars given to him by his daughter before every sea voyage. The captain put his hat back on, regaining his command character.
"How long do we have?" Smith asked.
Andrews gave the question serious thought. The ship can stay afloat from 1 to 1.5 hours only, the shipbuilder paused. Unless
what?
Andrews shook his head, battling with himself. That's too crazy a thing to ask.
Enough craziness has happened this night.
Smith opened his cabin door, too embarrassed to look Andrews in the eyes. The captain said,
I'm going to the wireless room. Then, for the first time in my life, I'm going to give the order to abandon ship.
How many on board, sir? Andrews inquired. Smith stood silent for a moment.
Too damn many.
The captain left Andrews alone with his blueprints. Again, reaching for his slide rule, Andrews noticed that the ship was starting to list to port.
It has begun, Andrews said. Dear God in heaven, it has begun.
Andrews started to cry. A deck, wireless room, 12:15 a.m. Smith could see the look of confusion on the wireless officer's face.
At ease.
Harold Bride stood in the wireless shack, dressed in his nightclothes. The young man won the captain's full attention.
Mr. Bride, Smith said with a smile.
Sir?
When the opportunity arises, change your clothes. Something warm, I should think.
Yes, sir.
Smith took a notepad from the room's workbench and set about writing map coordinates.
I want you to start the CQD distress code. We are sinking.
Sinking, sir? Bride laughed.
Foundering, Mr. Bride, Smith barked. This is not a comedy. We are done for, sir.
The wireless offer stood corrected. Seriousness once more returned to the room.
Our estimated position is 41 minutes 46 seconds north, 50 minutes 14 seconds west. Explain to all who hear that this position is based on old readings. We are sinking by the head. Our passengers are waiting, and that there are not enough lifeboats for all.
Smith looked at the two officers.
May God watch over your work.
Before Captain could explain further, an enormous explosion of sound echoed through the wireless room, a hot stream of steam and power.
What the hell's that? Bride shouted, concerned.
Not to worry, Smith reassured. I have ordered the shutdown of all the engines. We are dead in the water, sir. Our fate is in your hands.
Harold Bride and his supervisor John Phillips began their work. The two tapped out metallic dots and dashes over the seas, sending out the Titanic's desperate signal for help. The captain left the two to do their work. He had a serious chore ahead. To tell the passengers. A deck, first class promenade, 12:20 a.m. Dennis Parker was witness to the chaos that had been going on. Awakened from a deep sleep, he was greeted at his door by a rather pleasant-looking steward who told him of talk about an iceberg. Concerned, the captain had asked for all passengers to please put on their life jackets and to report up on deck. After a few minutes of confusion, Parker changed his clothes, drank a cup of coffee the steward was kind enough to leave, and started to search for his life jacket. It took some time to discover just where the cleaning staff of his suite had placed the bloody thing. By accident, Parker found 6 jostled together in his wardrobe closet. He noticed the life jacket's primitive lines, and really, not wishing to wear it, he strapped it around his waist, commenting that the buckles were uncomfortable. Parker discovered that he was not alone in his findings of the jacket.
The damn thing's too ugly, I say.
Like a bolt from the blue, the loud female voice caught Parker's attention as he was making his way to the bridge.
Mrs. Brown, I'm sorry. A crewman apologized.
Parker's eyes came to rest on Mrs. John J. Brown, an eccentric millionaire-ess he dined with once from Denver, Colorado. Pleased to see a familiar face and not really in a rush to find Andrews, Parker walked toward the little woman who, when she yelled, reminded him of his own grandmother years ago.
I don't care what your opinion is of me, young man, Mrs. Brown pointed out to the steward helping her. It's a shame these jackets don't come in bright colors. The clash is practically ruining my new outfit.
Really not concerned, the steward strapped Mrs. Brown's jacket, moving on to the next set of millionaires.
Yes, Mum, whatever you say.
Mrs. Brown said, with assholes like him in the world, I worry for the future. It was all Parker could do to keep from laughing. Dressed in a colorful feathered cloak and carrying a thick walking stick,
Mrs. Brown, or Molly, as she liked to be addressed by her friends, looked the part of a wealthy American. Well-rounded, loud-voiced, and old enough to be his mother, the poor woman still held within her eyes the fire of the early pioneer life. Advanced in age, Parker still believed that Molly had the strength of 10 men. He found her views refreshing, her language vulgar, and her manner lovable.
"I see that you've been invited to the party," Parker joked with a smile.
Genuinely pleased to see a familiar face, Molly grabbed Parker by the hand, shaking it with glee.
"Dennis, where have you been?"
"I've been kind of busy, Mrs. Brown."
"Mrs. Brown," Molly said, rather insulted. "Call me Molly. Only servants or people I don't like call me Mrs. Brown."
"Of course."
Molly gave the full deck a worried look. She noticed that the crowd of people had been growing as the clock ticked. She knew something was painfully wrong. Parker could see the worry on her brow, and it in turn was starting to worry him.
"To tell the gods truth, Dennis, this is a party I'd just as soon give notice to. What is all of this?"
"Got me."
"Some dude who rustled me out of bed said something about striking an iceberg or some such thing."
"Iceberg,"
Parker corrected with a smile.
"Bird, berg, what's the difference?" Molly laughed. "Whatever you call it, it's keeping me from my beauty rest."
"You're already beautiful, Molly."
A tint of blush entered Molly's cheeks. Parker could tell that although rough around the edges, Mrs. Brown was still a maiden at heart. The woman walked down the deck with Parker, proud to show off her escort.
"Just for that," she giggled, "you can buy me a drink."
"Delighted."
Bridge, 12:30 a.m.
"Gentlemen," Smith stated, "I find myself in a precarious position. I have it on the best authority that this ship is going to founder."
"Sir," asked Lightoller, "are you certain?"
"I have it from Mr. Andrews himself."
"How long do we have?" the second officer asked.
"Less than 2 hours, luck willing."
The captain nervously walked up and down the massive bridge.
"A hard fact is brought to light,"
Smith pointed out, taking his place by the ship's wheel.
"There are not enough lifeboats to hold every person on board."
Smith noticed the questions growing in the young officer's eyes. Young officers who, in their puzzlement, were turning toward the older ones hoping for some guidance. Smith wished that he had the advice to give. This was his first disaster as well. He was in virgin territory. The captain wished to carry on, but was interrupted by the presence of Thomas Andrews, who, looking at his folded blueprints, entered the room via the wheelhouse. Smith could see that the young man was going over problems that he could never understand. He felt sorry for the shipbuilder. There seemed to be a flood of demons biting at Andrews' troubled brow, just taunting him to discover a life-saving solution. All the officers turned their attention to the quiet shipbuilder. Andrews realized that he was being stared at, and a look of discomfort crossed the Irishman's face. Smith hated the thoughts swimming in his mind. He hated the idea of being stuck on a ship that wasn't meant to sit on the bottom of the ocean's floor. He hated what he had to do.
"We must not create a panic, gentlemen," Smith continued, turning his attention from the shipbuilder. "Therefore, to save those who are worthy, I shall only authorize the immediate evacuation of women and children. We will start with the first class."
Several officers grumbled in protest.
"Speak your piece," Smith ordered.
"Why just first class, sir?" Lightoller asked. "Are not all worthy of the saving?"
"Don't you know," Moody said, "the poor are too poor to take legal action once they are dead."
"You will stop that, sir," Smith yelled.
Murdoch stepped forward.
"Right. Men, you have heard the captain. Let's get to work."
The first officer sent men out to uncover the Titanic's lifeboats. One by one, the cold stares left the cabin.
"Thank you, Mr. Murdoch," Smith said with a tired gratitude.
"They're young, sir. Pay their sarcasm no mind."
The captain was left alone. Only he and Andrews were on the bridge. Smith forgot that Andrews was hidden in the shadows of the bridge. He took off his hat and threw it to the floor. The old man began to fight with himself.
"God in heaven, what have I just ordered my men to do?"
Smith moaned, fighting back waves of frustration.
Hundreds of people trapped below decks, separated by iron gates and locked doors because they were born poor, and I have given the order to ignore their pleas.
Smith paused, almost praying for guidance.
I have never considered myself a murderer. Dear God, how do I justify the blood left on my hands?
Captain Edward John Smith, Commodore of the White Star Line, started to cry.
Jesus, what have I done?
It is not our fault, Captain, said Andrews, moved. Smith turned to see Andrews looking at him. The shipbuilder's sudden appearance startled the captain.
Mr. Andrews, Smith said, rather embarrassed. I'm sorry. I thought that I was alone.
Nothing of the kind, Captain. No apologies are needed.
Andrews patted the man on the shoulders.
I had to cry myself. I'd recommend one to any person who needs it this night.
It's a difficult thing, Smith tried to explain, to see the death of one ship.
Andrews took a deep breath. The overwhelming sense of failure bit at him as well.
This is something we are both going to have to learn to live with, Captain. We are not the cause of the happenings here. We were the victims of magic or science. This was beyond our understandings.
Smith accepted this. He bent down to pick up his hat. He wiped off the gold braids on his cap's bill. Smith placed the hat back on his head and straightened his frame. He was once more in control.
Let's give a good show.
Smith brought Andrews' attention to the bridge's latest visitor.
Looks like we have company, Mr. Andrews.
Dennis Parker heard all that they had said. He stood at the bridge's entrance, staring blankly at his friend.
I think that the two of you should talk.
Smith left the bridge to supervise the launching of the lifeboats. 12:35 a.m. Alone, Parker had a chance to study Andrew's face.
What's going on here, Thomas?
The ship has sustained terrible damage.
How terrible?
Andrews paused.
We're sinking, Dennis.
Parker let out a nervous laugh.
I'm glad that you're taking it so well,
Andrews said, nervously studying Parker's reactions.
Tell me that you're joking, Thomas.
I wish that I were, Andrews explained. In less than 2 hours, this ship will be making the final plunge.
Straight to the bottom.
Andrews nodded.
Ever heard of a ship going anywhere else?
Was this Ka Ray's doing?
Parker asked, his voice stressed.
Possibly.
Parker cursed himself.
This is all my fault.
Impossible.
If I had heeded the warnings,
Parker paused.
Christ, I have been so stupid.
You're stupid.
Andrews chuckled ironically. Parker, tired of standing, took a seat on a nearby stool.
Thomas, you know how much I hate the water. I always have, ever since I watched my parents die.
I know.
Andrew's voice was soft.
I can't swim.
You better learn, old chum.
Andrews placed his hands on his friend's shoulders.
This ship is sinking, and there are not enough lifeboats.
Parker's fear of the water magnified his sense of hearing 100-fold. He could actually hear the cold splashing of the Atlantic Ocean against the Titanic's iron hull, slowly killing the ship an inch at a time.
How about a rescue?
Andrews rolled up his blueprints and blew out the fire on a nearby lantern. The bridge turned dark.
Don't count on a rescue ship anytime soon, my friend. We are at the loneliest spot on the planet.
Parker's heart started to race with pure terror. All he could think about was the agony of drowning. Chapter 14. A-Deck, First Class Promenade, 12:37 a.m. Kotz nervously patted the wooden flute resting in his pocket. He couldn't explain why, but upon seeing Ismay back to his suite, he had an unexplainable urge to get the instrument. As a sort of security blanket, it made him feel comfortable in times of stress. The detective rushed past several passengers who were complaining about being out on deck and found his way to the starboard bridge wing where the captain was observing the launch of a distress rocket.
Captain Smith, can I have a moment of your time? Kotz asked, waving his notepad in the air.
Mr. Kotz, Smith warned, watch yourself.
Upon hearing the officer's warning, Kotz took heed of a sailor striking a match and lighting off a rocket. It was a curious thing, hardly the size